Welcome to the Second Thought for the Day podcast. In this episode, we dissect a thought for the day to expose all in it that is not factful and reasonable. This episode is in response to the BBC's Thought for the Day from the 18th of April 2025. It was by the Reverend Lucy Winkett. Winkett works as a Church of England priest, currently as rector of St James Church, Piccadilly, in London. Lucy's inspiration was Easter, specifically Good Friday, the day on which her broadcast was made. As for her message, I think it's about the potency of the cross for Christians as a symbol. You'll have to make up your own minds. Much of what she said bordered on incoherence, and the remainder, I fear, was very much lost over the other side. We can at least celebrate the brevity of Lucy's contribution. It seems to have been written with a belief that whimsical deviation from reason, purpose, and structure is for some reason acceptable during Easter. We're going to have to dedicate some future episode to the Easter effect on Christian presenters of Thought for the Day. Back to Winkett. To set the scene, a parallel is drawn between the incongruities of Good Friday's grimness and the Christian faith using a cross as its symbol. Then, in the wake of Lucy's maudlin traipse through the lowlights of human behaviour in recent news coverage, things get a little unusual. Well, unusual for an anti-theistic and irregular frequenter of churches. Here is how she opened.
I'm sometimes asked why a religion would have an instrument of torture as its symbol. How can that be good? This healer, this prophet and poet, the one who called out the abuse of power in his day in state, politics, religion and economy, the one who pointed people, all people, to God, always to God, Jesus is not only put to death today by the occupying state, but shamed in public. Crucifixion is a torturous way to kill a person, and it's designed to be seen. Today's Good Fridays are not good.
We can begin with the simple stuff. Winkett says, today's Good Fridays are not good. Poppycock. On its own merits, this statement is a colossal generalisation and an evidently false claim. Winkett has apparently decided the Good Fridays of an unspecified contemporary era are, for all of us, everywhere, bad. Well, thanks, Winkett. But how about you mind your business and we'll mind ours? Would it really surprise Winkett to learn that many people find them perfectly acceptable? Winkett then claims possession of superpowers, prophecy and healing, in the character Jesus. Now, if this were a reference to, say, Superman and his ability to fly, we'd all be clear that the context was fictional. Not a problem. Here, though, I very much think Lucy is claiming non-fiction, in which case, no. Solid example of belief being presented as fact. We are then told that Jesus pointed all ways and all people to God. Now, I'm pretty sure Lucy's not even attempting to make sense anymore, but let's go with it. I think this could be fun. The population of our planet at the time the events of the Easter story are alleged to have taken place is thought to have been between 200 and 300 million. Some estimates go as low as 100. For the purposes of this digression, let's call it 250 million. Tiny by today's standards, but still quite a lot of people, especially if you have to find them all and point them to a god. The most populous regions on Earth in this period were in what is today eastern China and northern India. How very little changes. Before we explore what chance there was that Jesus was able to point all of the people on earth at this time to a god, it's worth examining what an unusual part of earth this Christian god chose for his Jesus landing party. The biblical lands in AD 30 encompass an area of about 1.5 million square kilometers. Specifically, this area is modern Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Syria, western half of Iraq and the northern half of Saudi Arabia. This vast territory had a population of about 1 million people in the year the Romans killed Jesus. Now, if we extend south along the coast to capture the Egyptian lands relevant to the Gospel's description of Jesus' life, then the population increases, doubles to about 2 million, but with negligible impact on the overall area. For political expediency, will refer to this territory as Greater Samaria. Make no mistake, at this point in our history, Greater Samaria was a backwater of planet Earth. There were 3 million people living in Japan at this point, which is less than one quarter the size of Greater Samaria. But these pockets of population are dwarfed by what at the same time is in China and India. There were 40 million people living at this time in the central lands of the Han Dynasty, an area of equivalent size to Greater Samaria. The Han in total ruled over 60 million. In a stretch of northern India, there were over 30 million people living at this time on lands about half the size of Greater Samaria, hugging the southeastern foothills of the Himalaya Massif. If you had a message you wanted humankind to receive on Earth in AD 30, assuming you had limited resources and you had to start in just one place, you'd have begun outreach in China or India, probably in Luoyang, the then center of the Han Dynasty and Henan province of today's China. Beginning in Nazareth would have been like waging a marketing campaign in the US today by driving from town to town in Oklahoma and shouting loudly from a soapbox in the square upon arrival in each. From what I've been able to gather, Christians believe their God to be all-powerful and all-good. Putting aside for one moment that almost any news bulletin from the history of news bulletins will likely contain powerful evidence that these two things cannot simultaneously be true, an all-powerful God would not be limited to selecting a single landing spot. If an all-powerful God did choose to run a Salvation for Eternity outreach program from just one place, and with just one envoy, you'd have pretty solid evidence that its motivations were perverse. And perverse is about the most pleasant way to put this of which I can think. Back then to Jesus' task of pointing all the people to a God. So let's forget for now that there were also pockets of humans in the Americas, in Australia, and dotted all over Africa. Imagine all 250 million were on the Eurasian landmass. Luoyang, the then capital of the Han Dynasty, is over 11,000 kilometers on foot from Jerusalem. There is a more direct route, but it requires going over instead of around the Himalayas. Agra, in northern India, is conveniently the right side of the mountains, but it's still 5,000 kilometers from Jerusalem. There are no newspapers. There is no email. There's no mass media at all. No telephones, no satellites, no flue powder, and no glass elevators. There was a postal service operated by and for the Roman Empire. But given they'd literally just killed God's messenger, it seems unlikely that Jesus was making a great deal of use of the Roman mail service beforehand. Now, biblical scholars have calculated, why is a question for another day, that Jesus walked an estimated 25,000 kilometers in his lifetime. These travels, though, were very much concentrated within the northern region of Galilee and Judea towards the south of the province, the Roman province of Judea. It seems likely the longest single journey Jesus ever took was no more than 600 kilometers, and I think that's quite a generous estimate. So, no, Lucy. Assuming Jesus was particularly good at having his pointing noticed during the few years he was actively ministering, he fell far, far short of your claim that he pointed always and all people to God. Who knows, though, what Lucy actually meant? There is an element of Winkert's today's Good Fridays are not good that's tricky to fathom. There's an implied comparison of those Good Fridays of today with some other Good Fridays. It seems likely that Winkert doesn't believe the original Good Friday to have been good, so perhaps she's claiming all Good Fridays are bad. We can listen to some more to see if it helps.
shaved heads, shackled hands, underground prisons, public executions in a football stadium. In our news cycle, we witness free rein being given to the human instinct to humiliate, the human instinct to dehumanise, the human instinct for revenge. Today's Good Fridays are everywhere. The lies we tell ourselves when we repeat the myth that violence is redemptive and degradation well-deserved.
No, I'm not sure it does help. At least not with the implied Good Friday comparison. She does reinforce her assertion of the badness of today, or at least today's Good Fridays, with examples from what we're told is in the news cycle. There really is, though, no useful information with which to determine what Lucy means. This appears to be an instance of plain incoherence. Now, at the tail end, we are provided with something with which we can work. The lies we tell ourselves when we repeat the myth that violence is redemptive and degradation well-deserved. In this, we have an indisputable logical falsehood. Winkert, without grounds, claims that we, presumably all listeners, perhaps all people, tell ourselves lies. I can find ways to support that idea. We do. The masters of understanding cognitive bias, Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, illustrated in the 1970s that our minds are almost incapable of not deceiving us. Lucy, though, goes on to specify a deceit. Apparently we, Lucy, and all other people, lie to ourselves that violence is redemptive and that degradation is deserved. Frankly, that's as rude as it is preposterous. It's also an entirely unsupportable false claim. Lucy, go ahead. Confess your problem with a belief that violence is redemptive, but please don't project your problems on your listeners or the rest of the world. Before we move on to the strangeness of Lucy's cross observations, we should return to her mention of the news cycle. While her meaning is indistinct with respect to Friday comparisons, her recounting of shackles, prisons, dehumanization, and revenge does appear to be a dip into declinism. Now, declinism is a fallacy. It's the belief, contrary to objective evidence, that a society or an institution is in decline, commonly resulting from cognitive biases where the past is viewed more favourably than the future. Rose-tinted spectacles, if you will, but for academics. Religious types, at least if those among them presenting thought for the day are representative, seem to be hardwired for declinism. In many ways, this is understandable. One might suppose if people were convinced that modern life were terrible, you'd be better placed to offer your ancient religion from a simpler time to people as a means to find solace from the hardship and the pain. But it's not just those preying on your soul who are vulnerable to declinism. We all are. It's not surprising given the assistance it's provided by our news media. News is more plentiful and more accessible than ever before, and news outlets have a significant preference for news that is bad. But that said, the excuse that everybody's doing it is not adequate. In 2017, Hans Rosling's posthumously published book, Factfulness, provided a brilliant and entirely accessible guide to how the world is in much better shape than most of us before reading it thought. Much of his latter life's work was based upon the idea that none of us can make or comment on policy decisions if we don't understand the problems that we face and those that we don't. His book was almost singularly responsible for initiating a U-turn in understanding among serious journalists in the UK who'd previously thought that our planet was in danger of overpopulation. The world is not without its problems, but those living in it today have things better than at any time in our species' history. Given the prevalence of declinism and the bad news bias of our media, it seems likely that claim will meet with one or two raised eyebrows. And so it should. The Royal Society has as its motto, Nullius in Verba, which I'm reliably informed translates into take nobody's word for it, or on nobody's word. This is, as far as I'm concerned, exceptionally good advice. Hence, it's also entirely understandable if you feel scepticism about the claim I made on what humanity faces today compared with any other time in its history. So please read Factfulness, and while you're waiting for it to arrive, visit gapminder.com. This is a website that Hans Rosling established to help close the gap between what we believe to be true and what is actually true about the world around us. Conveniently, it provides a selection of simple online quizzes that swiftly reveal how what you think you know compares to what you actually know about the state of the world today. And while you're at it, order Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature, which carefully distills tracts of research into a description of how much less violent our world has become. Taking just one measure of violence, even accounting for wars that currently rage, the likelihood of someone alive today suffering a battle-related death is around 2 in 100,000. That's a global average. This is astonishingly low. In 1960, that rate dropped below 5 per 100,000 for the first time since 1936. By 1971, it had dropped to below 2, where it stayed until 2021. Since then, it's been hovering just above 2. If you graph these figures, though, from 1900 to today on a sheet of A4 paper, the line looks completely flat and almost at zero since the beginning of the 1970s. We're living in one of the safest eras in history, and we are most certainly living in the healthiest, wealthiest, most equitable, and most educated time there has ever been. Not only is global overpopulation the opposite of the problem we face, consider these. The first world, third world comparison with which many of us grew up has long been redundant. Only 10% of the world's population lives in a low-income country, and that number is falling. The average life expectancy on Earth for humans is climbing. In 1800, it was 29. In 1900, it was 32. In 1950, it had climbed to 46. Today, the average life expectancy at birth, on average, on Earth, is 70 years. We're richer, we live longer, but we're also safer. In the last 100 years, deaths from natural disasters have decreased by more than 50%. 80% of the world's one-year-old children have been vaccinated against at least one disease, and only 6% of five-year-olds are underweight. 60% of the world's population feel safe walking alone at night where they live. And we've also done a tremendous amount to reduce the impact of discrimination. Globally, there's only a difference of 10% in the number of years the average 30-year-old spent in school between men and women. And homosexuality is legal in 65% of countries. Any reference to how terrible the world is today needs to be understood in the context of these numbers. When anyone seeks to advance their own views by making a general contrast between how bad things are now compared to some time earlier, they are engaged in deceit. Perhaps they're just lazy, and the convenience to them of the comparison outweighs the risk that might accompany researching the truth. Or perhaps they know they're spouting BS and I'm misleading you deliberately. In fairness, Winkert's dip into declinism was mild. We'll revisit that topic in the company of some other Thought for the Day broadcaster, as there are several who lean on this fallacy much more heavily. And finally, to Winkert's conclusion.
The reason that this cross is powerful and this day can be called good is not because we look at it, but because it stares at us, at humanity's cruelty today, and invites us to confront our fear, set aside our weapons, and live differently. The questions it raises are urgent. Is it possible that we can choose another way? Can we imagine that there is a love in eternity that holds the stars apart and that endures beside all whose hearts are breaking in quiet despair or cacophonous pain? This cross poses a question, throws down a challenge. It's a provocation. To see the world as it is, imagine it to be different, and resolve to make it so. So help me God.
What are we to make of that? I heartily echo that final sentiment. On listening to Lucy's conclusion, I too think of such phrases as, Lord, give me strength. The cross stares at us, claptrap. Although that really has nothing on love as an eternal restrainer of stars. Perhaps some poetic license should be granted here, but in a broadcast already struggling against a tide of nonsense, it seems unwise to indulge anything that swells the waves. Lucy manages here to be quite right, whilst also being profoundly platitudinous and astonishingly blinkered. First, the platitude. Wouldn't it be great if we could all be nice to each other and live in peace? This is a near-perfect example of the thought-for-the-day banalities about which John Humphreys complained in a 2017 interview. But Winkett is far from done. I think she's right about this cross-asking questions. But perhaps so narrow are her horizons, so insular her thinking, and so arrogantly held her belief. She sees nothing wrong with the questions she then chose. Unavoidably, this cross is a symbol of division. No more or less than a crescent or a star, they each represent an exclusive claim on supernatural knowledge of this world and a next world. They each claim to provide the only path to enlightenment and to salvation for all humanity. How can it be, with all we've done to improve human life on Earth, to improve our understanding of the universe in which our Earth sits, that we have emissaries from a medieval past who drone on about mysticism and superpowers, quite unaware of some genuinely powerful questions? Do you believe in immortal beings that live in the sky? Do you believe in magic? Do you really believe that your magic and your magical beings are true and heavenly, but not those of billions of others, whose are false and hellish? And surely the real challenge thrown down by this Christian symbol is, how does Lucy not see religion as anachronistic fuel for global antipathy? If only Winkett responded to the cross's invitation that she confront her fear, set aside the weapon of her ideology, and live differently. It seems clear this cross is for Christians a potent symbol, a reminder of all the terrible human things that Lucy lists, and a reminder that humans inflicted these things on the hero of their story. Why dress this message up in such meaningless twaddle? Aside from the declinism, the false claims, and the ease with which we can get a cross of wood to generate almost any question, if the message matters, why has Winkett put so much effort into scrambling it? Please don't listen to this broadcast. I've forced enough of it on you already. It is nonsensical, it's cliched, and it's wildly unaware of its shortcomings.